Hi, this is Barry Liston, Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. Would you characterize your attitude towards this podcast as positive, negative, or neutral? Unless you're in marketing analytics, you might not realize that the answer to this question provides a portal to the growing field called sentiment analysis. In today's segment, we speak with Dr. Maxim Tsvetovat, the Chief Technology Officer of the company DeepMile and a Research Assistant Professor at George Mason University's Krasnow Institute for Advanced Study. Together with Jacqueline Kazel and Alex Kuznetsov, he's written a cover story on sentiment analysis for the Informs magazine ORMS Today. Dr. Tsvetovat, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thank you for having me on the air.
Let me begin by asking, how do you define sentiment analysis and how is it being used to analyze activity on the web?
Sentiment analysis is essentially a quantitative technique for figuring out tone and tenor of a conversation. On a scale of, let's say, -2 to +2, with -2 being highly negative and +2 being highly positive, sentiment analysis gives us a way to assign a numeric score to anything from a line of text to an entire publication, and to basically quantify the emotional content of that piece. Taken in large aggregates, we can start saying things on the lines of the blogosphere treats the latest gun control proposal overall in a positive manner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it provides us a way to put a number on an emotionally charged speech and try to analyze this in larger aggregates.
And by using the simple scale that you just talked about, I'm sure it makes it easier for clients and lay people to understand your research.
Absolutely, because when we take this kind of a simple scale, so this basically maps to what psychologists would call the Likert scale.
That's true.
By using the simple scale like this, we can now talk about dynamics of sentiment over time, superimposing sentiment and volume sentiment, and appearance of certain keywords, sentiment and airing of commercial spots, things like this. So any kind of world events now can be correlated with how the world reacts through sentiment analysis.
And it has tremendous potential. I was reading an article in which one expert said that with sentiment analysis, you get the benefits of corporate espionage without actually doing corporate espionage. Would you put it that way? Would you agree with him?
Not necessarily going that far, but a lot of times I would see sentiment analysis being used as a replacement or a supplement to a traditional analysis methods like polling and focus groups.
So it's of great value to the marketer.
Really,
And, of course, to people
in
public
relations. Yeah, it's an enhancement rather than a replacement.
Your article takes issue with the validity of sentiment analysis methods that are generally used. Isn't the research being conducted scientifically, are the results accurate or not to the way you see it being done traditionally?
So the funny thing is, even humans are not very accurate as far as sentiment analysis. We are at best about 60 to 70%. If we were asked to estimate on the single variable on the Likert scale, whether the statement is positive or negative, even we would have a tough time agreeing with each other. And one of the reasons that is happening is, we have a very strong, I would say, poetic spectrum of emotions in our language. And it's very difficult for humans, and even more difficult for machines, to put a single number on that. So I believe actually one of the biggest deficiencies of traditional sensitive analysis is that it's essentially it takes something that is very complex and multidimensional, and it produces a single number out of it. And there is no way to avoid, you know, what a thinkable processing person would call an aliasing error, where two distinct measurements look very similar, even though they are completely different elsewhere. And that, of course, has a huge negative effect on the accuracy.
And it brings to the fore the question, how do you take into account things like sarcasm or double entendres or other nuanced speech that may skew perceptions?
Absolutely. Well, that's actually one of the biggest problems. There is one way of looking at this where certain words or expressions can be used as inverters of sentiment. So, you know, for example, the F word would be considered occasionally it's an amplifier and occasionally it's an inverter. So using the F word in the middle of a sentence may result in more in an inversion of sentiment. But occasionally it also results in amplification of sentiment, so and we don't really know. The other problem is, so double entendres are extremely difficult to detect. There is a paper out of MIT about 2 years ago where they talked about a computational linguistics method to detect double entendre jokes on Twitter. And it got a decent result, but it was specialized to one specific kind of a double entendre joke.
Now, is that the study that you mentioned in your... Is that the study you mentioned in your
yes.
article, the one by Samsonovic and Askely?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No.
Oh, all right.
So this is a study. I'm currently blanking on the authors, and this is something I can find later. But there is a study that puts a computational linguistics algorithm for detection of jokes that might end this, "That's what she said." So one specific kind of double entendre jokes, this is sexual innuendo, and that warranted about a year's worth of work by a group of researchers at MIT. So that sort of tells you how difficult this problem is. As far as the paper by Askely and Samsonovic, I think that opens up a much more interesting window into the sentiment.
Now, as I recall, it looks at grading texts according to four different dimensions. Is that right?
Right. So the way the study was conducted is they actually had people rate statements and rate pieces of text and videos on a very large number of dimensions. Then they did principal component analysis on this. The result was that there are 9 dimensions that have significant effect on perception of the data, and 4 of them account for approximately 70% of the variance. So those 4 dimensions, the first one, of course, is good to bad. That's where traditional sentiment is. Traditional sentiment only picks one. The other ones would be distance. So near or far, is this happening to me or to my immediate family, or is this happening to someone else? Immediacy, is this happening now, or is this happening later, or maybe this happened in the past a long time ago? Certainty, is this something that has happened for sure or will happen for sure, or is this something that may or may not ever happen? Sort of the strongest reaction was received, of course, when, you know, very positive events happening to you now and for sure. And the weakest reaction are things that have a weak valence, so not really negative or positive, and maybe in the past far away. So it sort of signifies and how much we care about certain kinds of events. This was actually confirmed with a study in fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, where subjects were placed in the machine and brain activation was measured on reaction to various passages in the text or various kinds of videos.
So you combined two different aspects of science to validate your results.
Yeah. So this is probably one of the first real studies that puts together semantic analysis and neuroscience. And I certainly hope to see a lot more of this type of work. Unfortunately, I don't see a lot of it being funded by various funding agencies. So my hopes are not high for the next few years. But this is an important area of work because it's really starts to tell us a little bit about the nature of language and about the nature of human cognition of language. But more than that, it will actually give us data sets that we can use for detection of online sentiment elsewhere and, you know, sort of port it to more concrete applications of sentiment analysis.
Let me remind our listeners that I'm Barry List, and they're listening to the Informs podcast, Science of Better. And today's guest is Maxim Tsvetovat of the company DeepMile, who's discussing sentiment analysis. This brings us to the original research that you and your colleagues have done. It begins with a word called mirroring. What do you mean by that in the context of sentiment analysis?
Mirroring is a psychological concept that has to do with how a person reacts to their conversation partner. Imagine that, for example, you are flirting with somebody. In a flirting type situation, if you have established real contact with the opposite, you are going to be repeating some of their gestures. If you want to do a little experiment at home while talking to somebody close to you, touch a quarter of your mouth. Within a few seconds, the other person will touch a corner of their mouth. Those kind of movements are unconscious. It's an evidence of mirror neurons in our brain, and humans have long since learned to exploit this. Mirroring is the technique that is taught in clinical psychology, and it is also a technique that is taught in schools for future spies, as an information elicitation method. So we took this well-known old finding that people do mirror people that they have positive affect with, and decided to port this to the realm of the Internet. Of course, one of the questions to ask will be, we don't have all of this body language, but we are more conscious about our spoken or written language than they are of the way our bodies behave in an interpersonal context. And so the question is, will this really port over to the Internet? And our answer is, so far, we see evidence that, yes, it does port over to the Internet. The way it ports over is the fact that when we use when we talk about a certain subject, we will use words and expressions that are good markers of the philosophies that we adhere to. So, for example, if you agree and spend a lot of time watching and listening to Rush Limbaugh, you would start using a lot of words and expressions that are very specific to Rush Limbaugh. And TV personalities, especially in talk radio, have spent a long time developing their own linguistic fingerprint. This is what they use to differentiate themselves from the competition and to make people more comfortable listening to them after they've had some time to acclimate. So what happens is if you have strong affinity towards a specific media source, towards a specific political candidate, you learn some of their characteristic words and expressions. This is what we call the marker words. And you start repeating them in your own speech. And that happens unconsciously. This is just the style of speech that you're used to, and this is the style of speech that you use elsewhere. So we can measure incidents of marker words and expressions in your online speech and say, okay, this person is speaking kind of like Rush Limbaugh, therefore he probably listens a lot to Rush Limbaugh, therefore he probably likes Rush Limbaugh. Similarly, we could take a set of different media sources. So in the examples we used in the paper, we took every major TV network from BBC to Al Jazeera to CNN and Fox, and we looked at their coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, specifically the conflict in Gaza.
And basically what you're doing is looking at media bias, and this is one example.
Yes.
So the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Right. What we wanted to see is, one of the new things about this particular conflict was that both the Israeli side and the Palestinian side have been broadcasting a play-by-play of the conflict on Twitter, using two very different voices. So the Israeli army had an IDF spokesman, and Hamas had their own Twitter account. Both Twitter accounts were very active. They were constantly broadcasting this updates every 15-20 minutes. So we have received quite a bit of direct speech from both sides of the conflict. So the next step was to figure out who do the world media sources tend to mirror more. And to that, it would become a proxy of the media bias.
And once again, this was in the, I think, November 2012 battle between Israel and Hamas.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you observe in terms of media bias?
So what we observed was actually fairly surprising. The most overtly pro-Israel, anti-Palestinian network being Fox News, actually appears in terms of the language that they use, appears to be the closest to Hamas. The funny thing
that is unusual
that was very unusual. So it prompted a closer examination, and what we found is not so much incidents of media bias in this case, but an incidence of what one would call radicalized. So when Fox News talks about this, they talk about freedom fighters, they talk about revolution, they talk about violent change, while other networks adopt a more measured tone. One of the other interesting findings was that Al Jazeera and BBC scored within about 1% of each other. This was curious because, not only because Al Jazeera is an Arabic network, but this was also curious because Al Jazeera is taking a serious effort to become the BBC of the Middle East. This effort includes hiring a lot of people from the BBC, and as it seems, it includes adapting the language of the BBC almost to the word. They use the exact same language, they use the exact same marker words, and in terms of their placement on the radicalization spectrum or support for Israel versus the Palestinians, they are within literally hair's breadth away from each other.
Did you analyze both their English language and Arabic language content?
I did not touch Arabic language content, partially because at the time the sentiment analysis algorithm only worked for English.
Oh, okay.
I have since ported this. It's been now tested in Spanish, and I have some support for 15 more languages, including Arabic. So, given the right kind of a test case, the software is there to try this.
Now, mentioning different languages also brings us to different locations, and you use something called geocoding. What is that, and how does that fit into sentiment analysis?
So, sentiment analysis gives us a score, but it gives us a score for an individual speech act. In the grand scheme of things, score for an individual speech act does not matter very much. What we really care about is what does a certain place or a certain group of people think. So, geocoding is a way to aggregate, not in terms of your location on the internet, but in terms of your location in the real world. What we do with geocoding is we look for any evidence of locations in your text. Looking at Twitter, there's currently four different places where location information can be stored. So if you look at all four, and we map it against the GeoNames database and against the zip code database in the United States, against postal code databases in the European Union, and finally, if all else fails, we look for possible misspellings. And we do get a lot of misspelled words.
Are those indicative of regional speech?
Not really. They're indicative mostly of sloppy typing.
Okay.
Occasionally there will be local nicknames for places. So New Orleans being the Big Easy, or New York being the Big Apple. Those things usually come up once or twice, and every time we see a nickname for a location, that nickname will be cached. So next time, it becomes much simpler to look up. So at this point, we have stored probably every single way of misspelling New York City that one could possibly have. That's by sheer virtue of having that many people tweet from New York City. We have much sparser data elsewhere in the country. It mostly has to do with how many people use social media in other places.
We only have time for a couple more questions, and I guess I should ask how accurate you feel sentiment analysis is at this point.
I would not, at this point, put a number on the accuracy, simply because it's, as I mentioned before, sentiment is a multidimensional problem, and really what we're doing here is single-dimensional analysis. And it's very hard to have a benchmark to measure against, since even humans are not very good at it. But what I think is happening here is I'm building a second method here that is very different from the original method. And what I'm doing is I'm allowing for comparisons between the two methods and also for building of a hybrid metric. I believe we can most improve accuracy by using hybrid metrics. And at this point, again, given not having a true benchmark to test against, I would hesitate to give you an accuracy number. But eventually I think we will come up with something that has a lot greater accuracy. And more importantly than accuracy, it will have a lot greater applicability. We don't just want to know exactly what you feel. We want to know why you feel that way. Why do you feel that something is important versus not important? And I think that's where we're going. That's going to be one of our biggest next steps.
And what do you hope to accomplish with this in the future?
Well, right now we are integrating this in production. This code right now is analyzing sentiment towards a number of different public affairs campaigns that are going on. We're going to take this to be able to function at much higher volumes. So that's step one. Step two, we're reporting this to 15 languages, so it's going to be a multilingual process. But as a researcher, what I would really like to do is map this to a real psychological experiment, perhaps repeating the experiment that Samsonovich and Afkali did, perhaps crowdsourcing on a much higher scale than has been done before, and really trying to get a handle on how people understand sentiment, especially if it's multidimensional sentiment. The final bit and I've said this in the paper, people in general are not very good judges of sentiment. If you want to know who the really good judge of sentiment is, look at the dogs. Dogs understand us, I think, much better than we do. I know my dog does.
I think you say in the article your final quote is, until sometime in the future, any dog understands sentiment better than most computers.
Yep. And I think better than some people as well.
And on that note, that's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Dr. Maxim Tsvetovat, the Chief Technology Officer at DeepMind. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening to the Science of Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research and Management Sciences. For more information about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.